Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, Jose Nino. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program featuring contributors to the Barnes Review Revisionist History Magazine, a bi-monthly politically incorrect print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts, as well as other special guests. For those interested, we are offering a free sample PDF of the March-April issue and a sample print issue of the Barnes Review. But if you want to fully subscribe to our magazine, visit our website, barnesreview.com. The website is your one-stop shop for revisionist history, which boasts a selection of over 400 revisionist history books. To take advantage of any of these offers, visit barnesreview.com, email sales@barnesreview.org, or call toll-free 1-877-773-9077, Monday to Thursday, 8 to 4 Eastern Time. To get your sample print issue of the Barnes Review, send a $5 postage to the Barnes Review at P.O. Box 550 White Plains, Maryland 20695. Good evening, everyone. Welcome back to the Barnes Review History Hour, where we uncover history that goes well beyond the mainstream. This is your host, Jose Nino, and this evening I'm joined by Hrvoje Morić of the Geopolitics and Empire podcast. How's your evening going, Hrvoje?
Super busy, doing well. I recorded a podcast this afternoon with the renowned grand strategist Edward Lutwak, so can't complain.
You've been on a roll, man. You are quite busy, and it seems that every other day, whenever I check my email or I go on Twitter, that you're churning out content, and you're definitely one of the quote-unquote OGs in this geopolitics alternative media space. So could you tell my audience more about your work?
Yeah, I mean, it was born out of, I think, 2012, if we talk about the podcast. You know, I graduated out of Geneva, international relations master's, and then I was looking for jobs, ended up in Mexico teaching at the top university high school here. And 2 years into the gig, I was just bored. And I started Skyping expert. I wanted to talk to intellectuals. The best way to do that was, you know, to create some sort of YouTube podcast or something. And this, you know, this is 2012. And so I started Skyping in. There's a channel, people can just find it on YouTube, called Dissident Thinker. And that's linked off of my main channel, Geopolitics and Empire. And there they can see I interviewed Lord Christopher Monckton on the climate narrative, Ray McGovern, former CIA, James Bamford, Robert Pastor, the father of the North American Union, Yves Zengler, the Canadian activist, John Perkins, the economic headman, Paul Craig Roberts. And so those were the types of, so that's where it all began. I just needed to satisfy my intellect. And then by 2015, I'm like, I was getting tired with the kids. The kids don't care. Even university age kids who are studying international relations, like, my mind was blown. I'm like, I just Skyped in John Perkins, the economic hitman, into the classroom. And most of the kids are like on their cell phones. And I'm like, what a waste. You know what? Screw you guys. I'm like, I'm going to formalize the podcast called the Geopolitics and Empire 2015, created the website, podcast feed, and all that. And I'm like, I'm going to just do one-on-ones with these guys and gals. And so, yeah, that's how the podcast was born.
Very intriguing. One aspect of your background that fascinates me is how you've lived in multiple countries, something that I share. And would you say that living abroad has given you fresh perspectives on how to view geopolitics? And has it also played a role in your overall outlook?
Yeah, I mean, it's if there's someone who doesn't have the ability, whether financial or other, to go abroad, but if they're particularly curious and read a lot in intelligence, they can gather a lot of out-of-the-box thinking and insights. But Yeah, living dropping yourself off into different zones, into different cultures. I mean, really just opens your mind. I mean, just by learning another language, a second or third or fourth language, and being exposed directly to different cultures. And also those people telling you their different ways of how they view, you know, most will tell you, for example, 9/11. Yeah, we question it. They laugh at the official narrative, just as one, you know, example. So yeah, it's really blows your mind if you have the ability to go into different cultures and hear the different perspectives that challenge your own. You know, I had a great, in Peace Corps Mongolia, I had a great Greek-American supervisor who said, you don't really know your own culture until you leave it and look at it from the outside. And so I think whatever nation you're from, you have to, at some point in your life, leave your own country. And even if you go as far away as you can to, you know, it's one thing if you're in the U.S. and you go to Canada or Mexico. Okay, Mexico can be kind of different. But if you go to like Russia, like I did, to Mongolia, it's really, you know, it helps you to experience a really radically different culture. I was in China in 2004. And so, yeah.
That is quite intriguing. And see, this is one thing that we really emphasize at the Barnes Review in our magazine, is the need to have as many perspectives, not just in terms of the ideological wavelengths, but also from people that live all over the world. We have contributors, not just across the US, but also in the UK, even people who live like in Eastern Europe and the Orient. And this allows for people to not just interact with other cultures, but also develop worldviews that go beyond like the very narrow index card of allowable opinion. Because when you live, like, say, like mentioned Mongolia or China, or even like your ancestral lands like Croatia, you are able to develop and basically look at politics in a way that's not exclusively informed by so-called Western liberal priors, because that's why the politics in the U.S., it seems so fake, because it's very stagnant and it uses like flawed assumptions. And it's actually quite insular too, funny enough, despite how multicultural a lot of these boosters claim to be. But I think that's what makes, I believe that what's what makes your show very special. What would you say was like your quote unquote political awakening?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to add on your previous note, you know, talking to a standard American on politics, it's like torture. You know, it's you'll yes. You'll, on any, you know, any topic, when you try to question the 9/11, you know, or whatever, it's, you know, they look at you like you're insane, like you're an alien, like you're a terrorist, like you committed, you know, a blasphemy or something. And it's just it's really infantile. It's really, you know, it's, I don't know, but my political awakening, I guess, be the 2000s, right? And well, 9/11, you know, it's, you know, when you're a younger person, you're not terribly, you know, you're interested, you know, in women, pleasure, things like that. But then as I get a bit older, I'm studying history and education, and, you know, 9/11 happens. I think Loose Change, you know, the documentary 2003, that was my big...
Oh, yes.
Awakening, right? So when you realized, wait a minute, my it's that turning point where most people, they're sleepwalking through life, and they assume, because, you know, they've never examined further many assumptions that were given. You're born, you go to school, you get older, you know, you work a job. I worked at a supermarket for 5 years as a high school kid in the north side of Chicago, and you're just kind of on autopilot, right? And so you just assume things because you've never really looked into them. They're just assumed. So you just kind of assume your government, you know, maybe it doesn't really terribly want to help you, but it's not, you know, out to get you. But then when you realize, wait a minute, 9/11 was carried out by elements of our own government. So like we're talking about democide here. You know, later, you know, when you mentioned COVID, it's like it's outright democide trying to kill us, you know. And so 9/11, then you learn about false flag terrorism, you know, state terrorism. I've interviewed Lance DeHaven Smith. He calls the late Lance DeHaven Smith, who wrote Conspiracy Theory in America, he calls it SCAD, state crimes against democracy. And then, you know, from there, it's the rabbit hole is endless. Then you learn about the Federal Reserve, right? And then, you know, Ron Paul. And, you know, you and I, we both hung out a couple years back at the Ron Paul Institute conference out there. So I got to meet Ron Paul, have him on my podcast. G. Edward Griffin, right, of the Creature from Jekyll Island. That's an interesting story. I met him in 2011. He took me out to lunch because I'd been assisting with his newsletter as a volunteer and passing through town. And his assistant's like, hey, Ed wants to take you to lunch as a thanks. So that, you know, those were awesome moments. But yeah, in the 2000s, you know, everything just unraveled through 9/11, the central banking, the wars, right? In March, was it March 2003 when Bush invaded Iraq? I remember in Chicago, I was marching, it was hundreds of thousands, I believe, people marching against the Iraq war. And so, and you realize it's all a sham, global war and terror. It's all just a complete sham. So, yeah.
And it's funny you mentioned 9/11 because I, when that happened, I was just too young. I was still in elementary school to really formulate a coherent opinion on that. And even going into middle school, I was actually kind of gaslit by some of the media just through osmosis, just consuming that and not really thinking about it critically. But it wasn't till high school when I started reading about Ron Paul. So you mentioned the Ron Paul connection we have. So that I began to question pretty much everything. And 9/11 was one of those events. I mean, for older millennials and even like the younger Gen Xers, that was a big turning point, I think, in terms of questioning the narrative. And you also mentioned COVID. And I think for younger people, that was their 9/11 in many respects, because I've seen tons of people, especially Generation Z and younger millennials, were quote unquote awakened by that event. And I think like these type of major black swan events are big in terms of not only how they shape history, but also in the type of dissent they foster. Because one thing that is very clear of the last century is the absolute domination of the managerial state and all these entities that really work to undermine many Western countries and destroy freedoms and install technocratic rule. When did you realize, because you now live in Mexico, when did you realize that the U.S. was not the so-called land of the free and like this holy republic that is exceptional?
Yeah, I just want to go back to what you mentioned on 9/11. You know, first of all, you know, once you understand all of that, and then I was just fascinated to study, you know, Daniele Ganser, right? The Swiss historian. I've interviewed him twice on my podcast. And, you know, just for me, it's been amazing to talk to pretty much all of my intellectual heroes. I've blown through 500 episodes on the podcast. And, you know, previously I did 2 years at Tunti Radio. You were a weekly guest there for a long time. And I think I did 1,000+ interviews in TNT. But when you study false flags, for example, it's like there's no end to it. And there's nobody innocent. You know, Russia, I believe the 1999 Moscow apartment bombings were a Russian government false flag operation. And then you discover, you know, Desert Storm in 1990, when they had the Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter crying about the Iraqi soldiers supposedly killing babies. That was a false flag. Vietnam, Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, World War II, you know, the Hitler, the Reichstag fire, or the Gleiwitz incidents, or, you know, the Lusitania in World War I. So it's just everywhere. I would say that's the principal, one of the principal ways warfare is waged. You know, you got the Nord Stream. I mean, you name it. And then the second point, COVID-9/11. I call it COVID-9/11. I just wanted to bring this up because this was on my mind today. Because today, the White House published the COVID website, the origin COVID origin story, and they're saying now that it was a lab leak. And my thought that I published today on the socials on that was, that's total BS, you know, because I will argue that COVID-9/11 was part two of 9/11. The goal was to bring
it out.
Right. 9/11, I believe, was part of the goal was to create this technocratic police state. And that was one of the first initiatives to do that. And then, you know, to make terrorism this global sort of legal term, so they can go after anyone that they deem a dissident in this global, you know, technocratic police state. Francis Boyle, who just passed a few months back, I've interviewed him three times, and he, you know, you had the anthrax attacks right after 9/11, and that was a false flag, right? And he said part of that, and that was a biosecurity event like COVID, and he argued that part of that was to help create the pretext to bring in the Patriot Act, which was to bring in the police state. And so when they bring in 9/11, you got the Patriot Act, which was ready to go. It was already, you know, all planned. And then that establishes the, you know, the first foundation, level one, you know, the first building block of, you know, the NDAA. They can now rendition any Americans, even non-Americans, but also U.S. citizens, for whatever reason. They can just declare you're a terrorist now, with no judge or jury or evidence, and toss you in Guantanamo for the rest of your life. That's what, you know. And so that's like phase one. And then it brings in the TSA, right? The Total Information Awareness Office they initially brought in. You know, all of this, all the spying, right, that Snowden and others have talked about. So that was the first building block. And then COVID-9/11, I argued, and to what they announced today, that it's a lab leak, I argue that cannot be possible because COVID was, well, you know, first of all, any official narrative can't be true, right? So if the government comes out and says this is the, you know, JFK, they still haven't told us the official narrative is false. The official narrative of 9/11 isn't true. So I don't think, you know, today's White House Trump announcement that it's a lab leak, that can't be true because this was planned months and years in advance, COVID. We had the Event 201 simulation of a COVID coronavirus in October 2019. The Chinese in September 2019 ran in Wuhan airport a coronavirus simulation. You had another in 2019, a urban outbreak virus simulation. You had Crimson Contagion in January of 2019. And so the fact that it was planned, COVID, means it cannot have been an accidental lab leak. And so, therefore, Trump's, you know, today's posting is false. And I said in March of 2020 that the purpose of COVID was to advance, to bring in global oligarchy, ruled by AI algorithm. And now you have Mark Andreessen and Joe Rogan recently. Both of them are saying, yeah, we should bring in AI, you know, to run
Project Stargate.
And yesterday, Russia Today published an article that a Russian minister said, you know, using AI, we can get rid of half of the political staff in Russia. So, and then, you know, you got Doge, which is the AI technocratic wrecking ball. Now the EU says, hey, we want a Doge. Russia says, hey, we want a Doge. It's like, is that any coincidence? So they want to bring in this global one world government totalitarian technocracy. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So that's just what I want to say. But then going back to your U.S. not land of the free. Yeah, going down that rabbit hole of the 2000s, like I said, 9/11, which then leads you to understand false flag terrorism. You study a bit of the Constitution, central banking. The central bank is actually, you know, private. And then you go down, you start learning about civil asset forfeiture. You know, there was one year where the police in the U.S., nationally, across the U.S., they, there was a story, people can find this. There was one year where the police, the government, authorities, the police stole more money from Americans than thieves did through civil asset forfeiture. They just, you know, they stop you. They take all of your cash, even though it's legit. It's, you know, and too bad, you know, you can't get it back. And they stole more money, the police, from innocent American citizens than it was like in the billions, you know. So once you start learning all of that stuff, it's like, oh boy, America is not what they told us. And I ended up in Mexico in 2010. And every country has its plus and minus. So with Mexico, the government functions less well. It's more of a failed state. So immediately when you come to Mexico, you kind of breathe this sigh of relief. Like, you feel freer because the government doesn't operate very well. So you actually have more freedom in Mexico. But because of that, the criminals, the cartels, have more power. So there is more danger in that sense from not the government.
Yeah, but it's definitely a trade-off.
It's a trade-off. And so, yeah, you know, that's when, you know, you sort of learn that the U.S. is not the land of the free. So they can just, you know, in the U.S., you can just be renditioned, even be taken out, you know. Michael Hastings, journalists, you know, oh, they take out their own president, right? John F. Kennedy. They took out the head of the U.N., Dag Hammarskjöld. You know, that was, I believe, there's a book, great book written on that, that it was done by the Western, you know, governments, Western intelligence. And so, yeah, you're Michael Hastings, reporter, his car, I think, was remotely taken over and rammed into a tree because he even said himself he was afraid that, you know, the FBI was looking over his shoulders. You know, Gary Webb, we can go on and on. And so, yeah, you eventually realize that America, that was my realization. I thought, you know, I was just living in another country, the United States. And then I realized, whoa, this is not a country. This is an empire. I'm a citizen of an empire. Like, the America is an empire, right? And then you know, talking to John Perkins, the economic hitman, then you begin to uncover this global infrastructure it's created of how it, through the World Bank, the Bretton Woods institutions, the IMF, you know, USAID, State Department, you name it, Color Revolutions apparatus, they put in puppets, you know, Saakashvili in Georgia, the Orange Revolution in Ukraine in 2003, was it? You know, on and on. You understand. Then you learn this global infrastructure that is the empire, close to 1,000 military bases. Trump just is going to increase the defense budget annual to $1 trillion.
Trillion, yeah.
It's insane. Like, what? So, you know.
Yeah, the biggest socialist program in the United States, the military.
Yeah, and back then I was calling it the United Soviet States of America, USSA. And this is like 2005-06, and I decided to permanently expatriate from the USSA. And it's funny, you know, Niall Ferguson, the establishment globalist historian, once in the blue moon he'll say something that's interesting, but he put out, like, he said, are we the Soviets, you know? And I'm like, okay, yeah. Niall, like 20 years ago, like 20 years ago I was saying that. Where were you, Niall? You know, but, you know, anyways.
That is actually a point that a guest of one of my podcast side projects, Joseph Jordan, also made, where he likened the U.S. to the Soviet Union. And he suspects that actually Ferguson may have ripped off and watered down his point, because Ferguson made that same point two to three weeks after Jordan published his article on Substack about it. And yeah, what I really like about your work is you show that none of what you see in politics is organic or happens like on a whim. It's often not just planned, but it's pre-rehearsed even. And if I am not mistaken, with respect to COVID, were there biowarfare simulations and other exercises conducted years prior to not just prime the population, but get like the political class ready to launch a type of pandemic scenario where they will use that kind of incident to justify a power grab?
Yeah. And just on the Soviet USSR comment, you know, I've interviewed Gilbert Doctorow. I think he's based in Brussels. He used to live or visit Soviet Union. And you know, one thing he told me that he now feels it's the reverse. He feels like America is like the Soviet Union in terms of police state. And, you know, Yasha Levin, the author of, I follow his stuff. He's a bit of a leftist. Don't agree with a lot of his left stuff, but he wrote the book Surveillance Valley, which I've had a copy. I haven't read it, but it's a very good book. They say about how, you know, basically the Pentagon DARPA created the whole entire Silicon Valley. But he just wrote a piece because he's Russian American, I believe, that it's, and Dmitry Orlov, who I've interviewed many times, that he has the same thesis as is Yasha Levin, that America will one day experience its 1990s Russia-Soviet collapse moment, and that, you know, maybe we're entering that. Although when I talk to today, like Edward Luttwak, people like that, and, you know, he's more of a Zionist, pro-Washington guy, he says America is still going to remain strong, and that Russia, Iran, and China are weak. And he does have some points. Like, Israel has just bulldozed the Middle East. Iran just keeps getting slapped in the round, and so is Russia. But getting back to your point of the biowarfare stuff, yeah, I mean, you had in 2001 Dark Winter simulation, and it's eerily just very much like, you know, what happened with COVID. And then you've had, I mentioned a couple already. You had in 2019, you know, you had Event 201. You had the Chinese running a coronavirus simulation in September 2019. I mean, how do they know months beforehand? China is doing it. Event 201 included Chinese CDC, I think, US CDC, CIA. Probably World Economic Forum, I'm not sure. And then you had Urban Outbreak. I mean, this is all just from off the top of my head that I'm thinking of. Crimson Contagion was run, I think, six months from January to June 2019. There's another one called Crimson Contagion. And then SPARS, I think, was another one. And so I think a lot of these were actually training because they brought in all of the actors, you know, state actors, different agencies, health agencies, media, you know, education, to train them to react the way that they did when they actually went live with the exercise in 2020. You know, you remember Pompeo telling Trump, there's a clip where they said, he said something to the tune, I don't know if you remember, he said like, the exercise went live or something, the simulation went live. And Trump was like, well, why didn't you tell me? You know, and so strange stuff like that. So it's clear that this was planned. And then a lot of people focus on some of the health medical issues, but I believe that the primary goal was to bring in technocracy because you saw QR codes, you know, digital passports, vaccine passports, checkpoint society. You know, you had to ask permission to leave your country, like Australia. You had to ask permission to leave your country and then to enter the next country that you wanted to get to. And they wanted you to carry around have these digital passports and controls. And so I think that was the primary goal of the entire project, like this total recall future, which they're pushing us.
It gives me vibes of like Demolition Man as well. And one thing I've noticed as well, especially in the United States, everything is now practically digital, where payments, like whenever I pay for something like in cash, the cashiers will actually look at me weird because they're so accustomed to like Apple Pay and other forms of digital payment or just like basic credit cards, to where things are going much more cashless. And honestly, the only times you'll see cash payments are going to be like very much in like ethnic neighborhoods, the U.S. among like Hispanics, like Mexicans and other migrant groups, but the rest of like the society is getting plugged into the grid across the board. And it's actually kind of creepy because the selling point is, and it's actually, there's some validity to it, that it's convenient. You don't have to lug a bunch of stuff or have like your wallet get it potentially lost and all that. But there's like, as we mentioned before, there's a trade-off where the government and all these corporations now have access to tons of personal data. And the U.S. is very notorious for being one of the worst countries when it comes to data protection, and not just from like with regards to the individual versus the government, but with corporations, the amount of spam calls, emails, and stuff people you get these days in the US, I largely suspect it's due to the mass amounts of information that these corporations have been able to compile thanks to how everything is so plugged into the grid now. With respect to Mexico, have you seen a similar trend, or is it much less pronounced compared to the US?
So it's much more insidious. And I've been one of the few lone voices screaming at the top of my lungs. But yeah, here in Mexico, it's the same program. So this is happening in all the countries, you know, and I go back to in 2020, in May, I got in June, it was published my interview with Edwin Black, right? And so he's that Jewish historian who talks about, you know, IBM and the Nazis and how the IBM created the first paper computers to be able to classify the population. And he calls this, I like his term, you know, you have the social credit system, the digital concentration camp. So he calls it the algorithm ghetto. And that's been my favorite term. And, you know, he basically explains what they're building is this digital gulag. So they're removing all exit and all choke points that are analog, you know, legacy, old world, and they're implementing digital versions. So, you know, you have a physical license plate, driver's license, no more. It's going to be on your phone. It's going to be digital. They're getting rid of now this week, announcing, you know, for passports or airplane tickets. It's all going to be digital. No more physical cash, digital. And so once we are on that digital farm or algorithm, in that algorithm ghetto, he makes good points. He says, they're not going to need to send Stasi or Gestapo to your house like they used to. They just press a button and you can't buy food at your local store. You'd literally just in a few weeks' time starve to death in your home. And your neighbor's not going to help you, because if they help you, they're going to have that button pressed and they'll be thrown into the digital gulag with you. And here in Mexico, I mean, it's advancing. People think like they escape to Mexico. No, you know, the Mexican presidents have been calling for North American Union. AMLO has been notorious for saying he literally says explicitly, we have to copy the EU and integrate Canada, USA, and Mexico. Mm-hmm. AMLO has called explicitly for world government. And then Sheinbaum.
I was just going to ask you about that. That was on my mind with the NAU, because I'm of the theory that in this era of great power competition, keep the US's empire afloat. I believe that one of the plays the political elites are going to tap into is by encouraging integration with Canada and Mexico.
And well, I continue with it. I'd argue, though, this has always been the plan, because we can go back a century and you'll find Cecil Rhodes, Carnegie, Clarence Strait in 1938 published a book called Union Now. There's maps of an integrated North America and British Commonwealth, which form the basis from which to then move on to the rest of the world to create world government. So, you know, there may be a point to what you're saying now, but I'd argue.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it can't be denied that this was always the plan. I mean, the 19th.
Knights of the Golden Circle, even.
I'm not familiar with them, but, you know, 1930s technocracy. I mean, how is it a coincidence that 1930s technocracy movement had a map called the Technate that included Greenland, Canada, USA, Mexico, all the way down to Panama? And Elon Musk's grandfather was part of that. And now here we have, a century later, you got Elon Musk running the show on completing that same project. And then Dugin, I was reading Dugin, Alexander Dugin, just yesterday, he wrote a piece for Arctos Journal saying we need to have this macro state of the Eurasian Union. So it's kind of like, wait a minute, Mr. Dugin, he even wrote a book on the Great Reset. So he rails against globalism, which is supranational globalism. Yet here he is, he does a 180. It's like cognitive dissonance. I don't understand it. I mean, I do kind of understand it. He's pushing a Eurasian Union which is the dissolution of the nation states of Eurasia. And it's a copy of the EU. And so how is that, you know, sovereign? And he even uses the term sovereignty. Like, to retain your sovereignty, you must join the Eurasian macro state. I'm like, dude, what are you talking about? It's like, to retain your sovereignty, you got to join world government? Like, that doesn't make sense, because that's the building block. It's for
Orwellian, yeah.
It's insane. And so these guys are either agents, you know, he's an occultist, I believe, you know, but just going back to Mexico for a second, I discovered I live in a 15-minute city. Like, you know, I was in Kazakhstan, COVID happens. In 2020, I'm like, we got to get the hell out of here. We got to get back to Mexico. We might be stuck forever. Like, they might not let us board a plane ever again without being injected. And I honestly thought I'd be stuck in Kazakhstan for the rest of my life, because I'm not going to get injected to get on a plane. We managed to get back to Mexico in 2020. It took us 5 days. And then I discovered in Guadalajara, they're building, you know, I'd been here since 2010. Nothing was really going on. And then I come back, they're building insane, like mass public transport, above ground trams all over the city. They're cutting car lanes, replacing them with bike lanes, you know, electric macro buses. Like, what the heck is going on? So I'm researching, and I discover Guadalajara is called a resilient city. I'm like, what the heck is a resilient city? And then I go to the main resilient city website, and it says resilience. There's many, you can research this now. There's many resilient cities around the world now, in the US, in Europe, all over the place. They're financed by the Rockefeller Foundation. It literally says that. So I'm like, oh, okay, now I know where the money is coming from, because Guadalajara doesn't have this money. Rockefeller Foundation is financing it. And in the white papers, it talks about cashless, you know, Visa. They're all working together, BlackRock, Visa, you name it. They want a cashless society, they explicitly state. They want pre-crime, like Minority Report. And then that's why Jalisco, where I live, the state, they're rolling out internet infrastructure everywhere. And so they sell it as like, oh, we want to connect everybody. Well, it's like, yeah, you're connecting us to the algorithm ghetto, panopticon, surveillance state, you know? And so, and you know, what happened to me last year? My debit card expired here in Mexico. Every time previously, I would go with official government identification, which was my US passport and Mexican passport. They renew it. I go this time, they said, no, you can't. You can only do it now with your INE, which is your Mexican voter ID card. And I never took one out, because I don't vote. And because I knew years ago that the Mexican voter ID card would be the basis for the national digital ID in Mexico. And now I can't renew my debit card. I still haven't renewed it, because they now only accept that as the only ID with which to do it, because it's the most complete identification in Mexico and it's biometric. And so I think the government of Mexico has told banks and other institutions, no, you can only accept the INE now, which is the digital ID. And that same week, the UN had the meeting late last year, the Summit of the Future, where the UN actually said, we want everyone to link their bank accounts to their digital ID. And so here I am in Mexico. They will not renew my debit card to take out cash from my account, unless I get my Mexican digital ID. And so, you know, and then there's a story of, and, you know, you're familiar with this, 2022, April, when the Department of Homeland Security, they rolled out the Disinformation Governance Board with Nina Yankowicz. And that literally that same week, Consortium News, Mint Press News, Caleb Maupin, and myself, specifically, we were all banned from PayPal. And it was clear as day that the Department of Homeland Security told PayPal, that's political persecution, you know. And I got a message from Kim Iverson and Matt Taibbi, and they both covered mine and our deplatforming. And then you had this week, former South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, right? Kristi is going to save us, right? Head of the DHS, and telling everyone, go out, don't delay, get your real ID, which is the American, you know, that's the where the digital ID in America begins. You know, in Mexico, it's the voter ID. in the US, it's the driver's license. I'm just going on a tangent here, but, you know, I think of like Ash Patel takes, you know, before during Trump's candidacy, it's like, we're going to tear down these institutions. I'm like, if they were true to their word, what they would have done was get into power, dismantle the Department of Homeland Security, dismantle the FBI. But New York Times, published this week, Kash Patel is trying to rebuild trust now in the FBI. I'm like, what are you guys, you know, what is...
Rug pull.
Rug pull. And it's, and the World Economic Forum years ago in one of their sessions, they had a session on how to rebuild trust, right? And so they just keep pulling the rug out from under us, you know?
Yeah, I mean... There's a lot to break down there. Now, with respect to Mexico, just to close this thread, have there been any credible groups or individuals in Mexico that oppose these schemes to effectively create a North American Union?
You mean opposition to North American
Union? Yeah. Yeah.
No. Everyone's out to lunch. The populace is completely zombified. I mean, I look around and I marvel. You've either got the lower classes who are just busy trying to survive, right?
Yeah.
The middle to upper class Mexicans, they've all been completely brainwashed. And you just take a look around. It's like, it's very consumerist. And everyone's, you know, Uber. I mean, people can't even make their breakfast anymore. I see often in my street, people ordering Uber Eats for breakfast. I'm like, what? Like, if this is the level of our humanity now, like you can't even throw a few eggs onto the pan and, you know, bacon and whatever. I mean, we're screwed. And so if it's Uber Eats for breakfast, and then they've all got their Netflix and the streets their streets are streamed with Amazon boxes, and they're building their third Costco now in Guadalajara. Walmart is investing $6 billion now to expand. So it's like in a few years, even in Mexico, the only shops is going to be Amazon, Netflix, Costco, Walmart, OXXO, no more, you know, local stuff. It's going to be like the Hive, you know, the Borg is taking over. And nobody, like, I talked to people, hey, do you know who Klaus Schwab is? Do you know what is in the World Economic Forum? Nobody has a clue about anything. Of course, there's a resistance. There always is. And it's very small. There are people, you know, in Mexico City and Guadalajara. There are a few Telegram channels and YouTubers. You know, Ruben Luengas, he's a veteran Mexican journalist. I just had him on the Spanish edition of my podcast. And I've been so far a guest twice on his YouTube. He's got over 100,000 subscribers on his YouTube. He's interviewed Obama and Hillary and Mexican presidents, you name it. And now he gets it. He's like a conspiracy YouTuber now. So there are these small pockets, but nothing to really create enough resistance, so we're basically screwed. You know, we are screwed.
I mean, that goes to show the power of like U.S. soft power, because if you go anywhere where the U.S. is like adjacent to, or where it's like a basic like sphere of influence of the U.S., you see like the same type of lifeless co-working space environment where people shop from like the same brands like Starbucks, or they're just glued to their smartphones. Getting Uber Eats, as you say, and just acting like automatons. They're no longer human. And that's kind of done by design. Cause when you turn people into deracinated, rootless economic units, that is the best thing for the ruling class. And I actually agree with your point. The Gestapo, like Soviet Union, like Stasi model that you were talking about, of getting some jackboot knocking through your door and like dragging you out and throwing you on in a gulag, that's not necessary anymore when you have people basically zonked out on all manner of soma, ranging from like Netflix to social media as well. And people are just enslaving themselves.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. You know, it's not once in a while order Uber Eats or something on Amazon, fine. But if that's just like what you're literally doing every week, I mean, that's a whole other ballgame.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, like technology is going to exist, like, and I use it as like a tool, but when it becomes an end in itself and it becomes a part of like your everyday lifestyle, that's when it gets creepy. I want to go back to the point about COVID, because let's kind of like shift our gaze more like in a geopolitical sense. Do you think this COVID hysteria is also another way to prime the population for a potential conflict with China? Because I remember now, because we were talking before the recording about Ron Unz, who we had on the show a few weeks ago on the Barnes Review History Hour, who I believe was also on your show. He made an interesting point. He had a very contrarian theory where I think, if I am not mistaken, he was saying that COVID was actually a U.S. military plot that was essentially launched against China, and then they were able to like gaslight the entire population of the U.S. into making China the culprit, when in reality it was a U.S. biowarfare thing. But just to tie this back, do you see the angle of this COVID hysteria as like one of the first stages towards escalating a U.S. versus China war?
Yeah, so I've interviewed Ron on my TNT show. He's been on the podcast. And I'd go back to my interview with Canadian scientist Denis Rancourt, who was very good. And in my interview with him, he said that, I think he had a strong point. He said COVID was, if you think about it, it was like a war simulation. It was effectively a simulation. It was like we were at war, but we weren't, because you had lockdowns, checkpoints, rationing, you know, no free speech, effectively like martial law in all nations around the world. And so I think he had a strong point there. I do differ from Unz, where, you know, he says it was like an economic attack on Iran and China. And a few folks that I've interviewed, you know, Denis Rancourt, I like his work, but he still has faith in BRICS and multipolarity, whereas I believe they're all in on it. Everyone's in on it. And so it's basically this transnational elite that stretches from Beijing to Moscow to Brussels to London to Washington against us. So it's no longer a horizontal conflict. It's vertical. It's the elites at the top versus the populations of all nations of the world. That's how I see it. And so I've interviewed, you know, Francis Boyle. When I interviewed him, he effectively said the same thing, that it's the, you know, it's the Russian elite, it's the Chinese elite, the American elite working against their own populations. That's World War III. It's a scientific dictatorship. I interviewed William I. Robinson. He's a leftist academic, and he nonetheless, he's got very fascinating books on global police state, and he calls it the global civil war. So the economy is you know, debt, it's crashing. And he says effectively, because I asked him, he said, you know, he's the Russian elite are looking out only for their own interests, and they're going to use these technologies to keep the Russian population down, just like the Chinese will, just like the Europeans will, just like the Mexican government will, Mexican elites. And so I see it more. And you know, Russia and China played along. You know, they all brought in the QR codes and the mandated injections and, you know, all this thermal readings and everything, passports. So if it really was an assault on, you know, why didn't anyone call it out? You know, except for Lukashenko and Belarus, you know, he revealed that the IMF, and that tells you where it was, you know, IMF, World Bank bribed him to lock down. And he's like, no, screw you guys. So I view it more as they're at a stage now. I focus a lot on world government, which I think COVID was one of the accelerations. I feel like they're behind, which is why you see them all of a sudden trying to brute force North American Union into existence, and through COVID trying to brute force implementation of technocracy and global government. And so I just view them all being in on it. And I interviewed Emmanuel Pastryk, who also had a amazing analysis on his Substack a few years ago of COVID. And he said, you know, it was clear that again, this was an international plan, and it was done through like boutique IT companies, private, IT companies, financial sector. And they effectively gave, the Chinese, all the different governments, they gave them the policy to implement, McKinsey Consult, all these like different agencies you've never heard of, McKinsey Consulting, BlackRock, UN agencies, Rockefeller Foundations, and other foundations. That is the, that's the beast. It's made up of all these different things. And like in Mexico here, it's not the Mexican government isn't running anything. It's BlackRock, it's Rockefeller Foundation, it's UN agencies, it's countless foundations. They give these policy recommendations for the government, Mexican government, to implement, to the governors, to the mayors. And so I feel we have increasingly just very little sovereignty or agency. We've effectively been taken over.
Yeah, that makes sense, because when you have a weak state like Mexico, transnational organizations, NGOs, and all those other entities, they will wield more power in those type of societies. And that's kind of like what you see in the U.S. as well, where politicians have actually become increasingly irrelevant. And now you're seeing bureaucrats, like permanent bureaucracy, and NGOs and corporations too, especially with this weird PayPal mafia, little tech alliance that Trump has forged, that you're seeing the U.S. is no longer going to be, well, it hasn't been for some time, but it's now not going to be like a democracy any longer, where voting for like an elected official to represent you, that's just going to be symbolic, because the real policy is being made in like the think tanks, in these roundtable meetings, and the permanent bureaucracy. Your representative is at best a cog in the machine. They're not going to do anything to really roll it back, and if anything, they're going to be rubber stamping it. What do you make of the present, like what's happening in the present with Trump's second term and all of that? Do you see it as more of the same, or do you think that there is like a possibility for people like us to genuinely push back against the establishment?
I mean, I guess you get some good stuff. There's good, words thrown out, like getting rid of the IRS, but I'm sure you're familiar with, what's his name? Is it Ryan McCacken or something? He just did a video on, they're not going to abolish the IRS, Howard Lutnick, I think this guy just looks out for himself. He's a billionaire, and he's like, oh
yeah, sleazy. Yeah.
Yeah. He's talking about his mother-in-law, who was like 94 or something. It was a clip the other day. And he's like, it's no big deal if you don't receive your Social Security check. And he was talking about his mother-in-law. Wait, for her, it's no big deal, because you're worth $2 billion.
Yeah, you're rich.
Yeah. And he comes out and says, robotics are going to replace cheap labor in America. I'm like, well, I mean, it's absolute insanity. And so I think the attitude is on one hand, you'll take whatever small victories you can, but I'm completely cynical when it comes to politics. I think it's been completely taken over. You see, RFK, the guy during the 2020s, I mean, he was in Berlin giving this amazing speech on how COVID was totalitarianism and globalism. And once he gets, like in Lord of the Rings, once he puts on that ring, ooh, you see a 180. Tulsi, right? Now she's pro-surveillance, pro certain wars. RFK, the other week, he said MMR vaccines are the way to go, where you can find clips of him, years ago saying he would never give MMR vaccines to his kids. And it's just like, what in the world? I already talked about Kash Patel and Kristi Noem saying, get your digital ID. It's like, I don't have much faith there. I recently, this week, I interviewed Pastor Chuck Baldwin, hour and a half. It was third time on the podcast. He said, we were talking about technocracy and Zionism. And he said, it's interesting. Trump said to the Christians, elect me, And you won't need to vote anymore after 2028. And then, you know, you've got J.D. Vance. And so this is what Chuck Baldwin was saying. He's like, what does he mean? You know, because part of oligocracy is there's no more voting. You don't need to vote anymore because the AI algorithm runs everything now. We could just confide in the AI and the software, and you guys don't need to vote anymore. All of the best options will be selected automatically by the algorithm, which knows more than we do. And then you see J.D. Vance. He was positing maybe after Trump we'll get a Vance because he seems to be more important because he's backed. He was, I believe he's a total creation, you know.
Oh, I agree too. Yes, I agree.
Yeah, and then you got, you know, Peter Thiel basically invented him. And, you know, I don't think Peter Thiel necessarily is some where the buck stops. You know, yeah, sure, he's Bilderberg, Palantir, CIA. But there are darker forces, you know, even the further and further we get behind the curtain, so.
Yeah, the thing I've been arguing, Vance, like people forget this too because of the short-term memory that afflicts most political observers. In 2016 up until 2018, he was actually a never-Trumper. He was saying nasty stuff about Donald Trump, but then he like somehow changes his mind. And yeah, his background, he was very much groomed. He says all the right things and uses all like the right talking points. Like he has done his research on the so-called dissident right and a lot of the populist sphere where he's able to copy these talking points and say them to just win votes and win favor among these constituencies. But he's carrying out a plan of a part of like the oligarchy that just wants to accelerate towards AI, and these people are all connected, like from Elon Musk to Peter Thiel. Like these people are very creepy, and I don't want anything to do with this type of stuff because it is going to lead towards a very dystopian political environment.
Yeah, I mean it's hard now for many of the MAGA folks to see. You know, part of it, I liken it to we've been psychologically tortured for so many years now. I mean, in many ways, you know, it's been like CIA torture, everything, you know, the past decade going through. And some people at some point, they just can't handle it anymore, or they're going to have literally a physical and mental breakdown. And so they have to, you have to cope. I mean, in any scenario where you're being tortured, you know, and part of their copium is, you know, pulling on the tails of Trump, you know, trying to find hope there. I think for people, you know, there's myself like a Christian, you know, I find my solace or hope in the metaphysical or spiritual, which is why, like, I have no problem understanding how bad the situation we are in is. There are people who are not Christians that are still able to see things as they really are. But somehow, you know, they're able to do it for other reasons. But yeah, I mean, even the border issue, one thing that's freaked me out also with the algorithm ghetto is now they've psyoped the conservatives into, because, you know, they let all of the mass illegal migration, they did it intentionally. I mean, look what's happened in the UK. Tony Blair just came out and he's pushing hard. He's at the spear tip of pushing digital ID. And they just said, look at, you know, all this mass migration that's come in, we need digital ID to solve it. Well, I'm like thinking, well, I mean, you guys could have stopped them years ago.
Problem, reaction, solution.
Right. It's like, so you intentionally let them in. So years later, you can come out and say, hey, look, guys, we need digital ID. And, you know, the senior advisor to the Tony Blair Institute this week on Twitter came out with the video and said, like, I mean, I just almost fell off my chair. He's like, in the video, you can look it up, Tony Blair Institute on X. He's like, digital ID is not about government control. I'm like, that's literally what it is. And he comes out with a straight face and say, digital ID is not about government control. I'm like, are you kidding me? And now, you know, Boing Boing, which is a leftist publication, but they put out a really good article the previous week talking about real ID and talking about World War One and dystopia. And think about it, you know, before World War One, you didn't need a passport. You could just travel the planet freely. And then, okay, we had to get passports and visas to go anywhere. And now we need a visa for our visa. It's because now the UK just in January activated something called the Electronic Travel Authorization, ETA. The EU meant to already have implemented it, but they've now pushed it back to 2027. And it's called ETIAS for Europe. So it's basically an electronic travel authorization. And so now if you've got a US passport and you have a visa for Europe, you have the automatic visa, I believe, where you can go to Europe, you know, 30, 90 days, whatever. It's already visa included. No longer. Now you won't be able to go to the UK or Europe unless you fill out the electronic travel authorization. And this already happened to a guy. I think he's an American Christian YouTuber. I don't know his name. He's got a big account. He spent thousands of dollars on plane tickets, hotels. He was going to go to Jordan Peterson's ARC conference. And he didn't know he had to fill out the ETA. He fills it out and he gets denied. And it's basically like a social credit form. It's a thought crime filter. So the UK or EU, when you fill out the, you got to pay 10 or 20 euros or pounds. And then it checks the data, like you were talking about earlier, all the data that they can get by, you know, from corporations, intelligence, and they'll check all of your views, religious, political, whatever. And if they don't like it, you know, sorry, you can't come to Rome. You can't see the Colosseum. You can't see the Eiffel Tower. You know, you can't come. And that's now being activated. And so it's absolutely, and that's the entry exit system, you know, and so it's going to be total control. Like it's literally going to be a prison planet. You won't be able to. And so that's how they're selling conservatives with the border issue. Your digital ID is going to solve the migration thing, but it's going to be like, guys, no. That's going to be...
There's a more analog way of doing that.
Yeah. I mean, for all of human history, you know, there's been an analog way. So
yeah. Well, I think this is a good place to just leave our listeners with a lot to reflect on, because this was a great conversation about the many challenges we face. But before we leave, Hervoye, let the audience know where they can keep up with your latest projects.
Yeah, always great chatting. Geopoliticsandempire.com is the website. And then, you know, on Apple, Spotify, all the audio places, you'll find the podcast. And on the videos on X, Substack, Pentagon Tube, as I like to call it, Rumble, Odyssey, BitChute, Brighteon, active on Telegram, 13,500 subscribers there. I post stuff daily and X. And yeah, the email list is through Substack. And I got a paid version, which is how I survive, where I do a weekly analysis of the global events. And we do Zoom calls every week or two. Supporters, we do like an hour or two, or you shoot the breeze. It's kind of like a conspiracy New World Order therapy session. And there's a Spanish version as well that's through the website, where I'm a bit behind, but I've launched I interview Spanish experts on all of these topics as well.
Fantastic stuff, Hervoye. You're always welcome to come back, because I find your insights to be fascinating. And to the audience, thank you again for listening to the show. And do not forget that you can still receive a free sample PDF of the May-June 2025 issue of the Barnes Review. We have several articles in that issue, which include the Communist Misrule in Soviet Kazakhstan by Matthew Raphael Johnson. And also, do not forget to check out our bookstore, which has a collection of close to 400 books, many which you cannot find anywhere else. And as always, for the Barnes Review History Hour, this is Jose Nino signing out.